Good afternoon, everybody. We're here at the concurrent session, Taking the Lead, Mental Health. Just a quick reminder to, complete feedback forms, and when it's question time, to please identify yourself before asking your questions using the microphone, because this session is being recorded. Let's introduce our speaker. We have Young Go, currently working for AIA Australia in group pricing, where he leads the pricing team responsible for AIA's in-force group life business. Young has written several papers in the past, including Managing Disability Claims, which came runner-up in the 2011 Aluka Turks Legal Scholarship. He's grateful for the opportunity to present on the topic of mental health, as this was an area where he has been seen firsthand a friend go through a period of mental illness and feels there are a lot of positive developments in this field worth being aware of and discussing. When he's not busy at work, Young enjoys playing with his young son Liam and traipsing around the New South Wales countryside with his wife and son and taking lots of photos. He claims not taking too many, but just too many photographs, and savouring the good fare from the local eateries. I should also admit I have a strong personal interest in this field of mental health, as it's an area one of my younger sisters was something of a national figure in the community mental health side of things. So we're looking forward to this. This is a session designed just to keep an open mind and to facilitate a good discussion at the end. So please make your notes as we go along and let's have a good discussion. I'll hand you over to Young.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming along. Could I get everyone in the room, firstly, if you are feeling not so shy, to move forward? This is a big room. You're entitled to sit where you are, but it does help a bit, I think. But can you please take a look around, because and look at the people around you, because according to the statistics, one in every five of us is expected to experience a mental illness during the course of our lifetime. Now, globally, mental health is of such a concern that according to the World Health Organization, depression alone accounts for 4.3% of the global burden of disease and is among the largest single causes of disability worldwide, accounting for 11% of all lives lived with disability. The theme of this conference is taking the lead. And if there ever was a topic worthy of consideration in which leadership was required, I feel that mental health is one such topic. Before I go further, as John has kindly explained, I'm not an expert in this field. I don't have a psychology or psychiatry degree. I'm speaking as a layman. But I feel the challenge that I wish to bring to us is for each of us, individually and corporately, personally and professionally, how are we going to change the status quo for the better in relation to mental health? Well, where to from here? We'll look at some foundations, and then we'll look at some current trends before turning to mental health and insurance, and then we'll take a deep dive into some current thinking in claims management, and then looking at some fairly recent advances that I believe are cause for hope. My interest in this is twofold. It's both personal and professional. On the personal front is my friend, let's call her Laura, who as a child had the unfortunate experience of experiencing there was infidelity in her parents' marriage, and there was a breakdown in trust. And because of this, it impacted her development, and it subsequently led to her experiencing anxiety in the workplace. Thankfully, she reached out for help, and with the help of friends and the treatment that she received, both from a psychotherapy perspective as well as some medication, Laura got better. But not everyone has such a good news story. Professionally, in my role in group pricing, I encounter mental claims almost every day in the context of claims experience of the funds that we're looking at. And it seems to be a trend that has no end. It just seems to be rising and rising. Yet for me, the drive in preparing for this presentation is my suspicion, and I did test this in some limited way, that you know, mental health is an area where there's a lot of stigma, there's a lot of prejudiced opinion, but are we guilty of that? And I'd really like us to challenge our thinking, because if mental illness accounts for more than 160 million in claims per year, and this is just from a group life perspective, are we giving the subject enough thought, and can we deal this accurately quantitatively if we haven't invested the necessary effort in understanding the issues qualitatively? Until we do, then mental illness will remain for us, as it does to much of the population, subject to stigma and myth. Unless we walk in the shoes of a sufferer and understand their desire to be free, will we be guilty of projecting onto them our potentially unfounded assumptions and prejudices about their motivation to return to work? I mean, I can think of a recent group scheme where we looked at a particular company and they were highly paid executives, and some of my colleagues were saying, oh, there's a lot of stress in that corporate environment, they're going to go and claim and they'll never come back. But is that a fair assumption? And would we form that opinion if we knew personally people who were in that situation and saw firsthand how really their overriding desire is to get reintegrated back into society and to get better? A large part of the difficulty, of course, is that mental illness is an invisible illness. And I've got a picture there in that diagram. And that came from the National Geographic, where they were doing some work amongst soldiers who were experiencing mental disability from shell shock. And of course, where the treatment that they were getting these soldiers to do was to draw with using art to express what they were feeling. And that's what that particular soldier saw. Of course, if you saw him in a day-to-day situation, he'd look like a normal person. You'd never see what he was feeling. But that's how he feels. And mental illness is another, is unique in the sense that it is perhaps the one illness that affects our ability to connect and relate to other people. Because of that, it's particularly isolating. And because communication is the means by which psychotherapy is delivered, this makes it a particularly challenging illness to solve. If, as a result of this talk, this presentation, the conversation around mental illness grows louder, stigma and myths continue to fall for at least some of us, then I feel that this presentation would have been worthwhile. Let's lay some foundations. So the brochure that you see there has been put up by the Department of Health, and it talks about what mental illness is, which is a general term referring to a group of illnesses in the same way that heart disease refers to a group of illnesses and disorders affecting the heart. Mental illness affects the mind. As such, mental illness significantly affects how a person feels, thinks, behaves, and interacts with other people. Once you start to consider the complexity of the brain, and Thomas Insel, who's the director of the National Institute for Mental Health in the United States, says, the brain is an organ of surreal complexity, and we're just beginning to understand how to even study it. When you think about whether you're thinking about the 100 billion neurons that are in the cortex or the 100 trillion synapses that make the connections, it's such a complex organ. It's hardly any surprise then that one in five, if you had a machine that was so complex, wouldn't you expect it to break down? So that's how complex the brain is. In the 2007 National Survey of Mental Health and Well-being, mental disorders are classified into three broad groups. There's the affective or mood disorders, These cover things like depression, dysthymia, bipolar affective disorder. You've got anxiety disorders, it's the second group, and these covers panic, agoraphobia, social phobia, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And then you've got substance use type disorders such as alcohol, harmful use, alcohol dependence, and drug use disorders. What are some common treatments? You've got medication, you've got cognitive and behavioral psychological therapies, psychosocial support, psychiatric disability rehabilitation, just to name a few. From a definition perspective, in the ICD chapter 10, it's the chapter 5 group of illnesses, mental, behavioral, and neurodevelopmental disorders. There are changing views on mental health. Their old assumptions are being challenged and new treatments are being discovered, as we shall see. And there's been an oscillation of views about whether mental health issues are primarily psychological and therefore to be treated with psychotherapy, or are they really chemical imbalances in the brain to be treated by psychopharmacy, or what else? So there's been a range of different thinking around this subject. The good news, the slight glimmer of news, is that there has been, over time, a greater social awareness and acceptance of mental illness. This is perhaps one of the reasons why, from a claims perspective, because it's becoming more acceptable to admit that you have a mental illness, you know, we're seeing claim rates rise. Along with that, just because we're seeing more claims, it doesn't mean that these claims are permanent. With the increase in efficiency in treatments, they don't have to be permanent conditions. Let's look at some current trends. Mental illness is such a serious issue worldwide that the World Health Organization instituted a Mental Health Action Plan 2013 to 2020. And for those of us who feel that it's just in the mind, we're rather a bit skeptical about this. Excuse the pun, it's in the mind. Suicide is the second leading cause of disease of young people worldwide, according to the World Health Organization's first global report on suicide prevention, which was issued in September of last year. 800,000 people take their lives every year. So we've been going for, about 5 minutes, John? At least 5 people have taken their lives. That's how real it is for them. That's how much hope they've lost in that situation. Some of the reports on the right talk are from the US. The one in front is from Europe. Around the world, really, the trend is for an increase in mental illness. I've already mentioned how depression has been cited from the World Health Organization to account for 4.3% of the global burden of disease, and is among the largest single causes of disability worldwide. The estimated global economic costs of mental disorders in terms of lost economic output between 2011 and 2030, is estimated to be $16.3 trillion. So that's how massive the situation is. What about mental health and insurance? A report put out by AIA in 2013, you see the graphic on the right. We pay group insurers, not just AIA, as an industry, we pay over $160 million per year in mental illness claims. According to the World Health Organization, again, people, and this is the quote which I'll read out because it's quite small, people with mental disorders experience disproportionately higher rates of disability and mortality. For example, persons with major depression and schizophrenia have a 40 to 60% greater chance of dying prematurely than the general population, owing to physical problems that are often left unattended, such as cancers, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and HIV infection. How are we as an industry responding? we are responding from a group life perspective. Product definitions are changing. Claims management approaches are changing, and we'll have a look at what is changing there in a few slides along. We are being more proactive, but are we being proactive enough? For instance, an area that I'd like to challenge is it ever warranted paying a lump sum for mental illness? Now, I have to be careful here. This is not to disadvantage unfairly those with a mental illness condition. It's not to deny them the support, but can we give them the support in another way other than by paying them a lump sum? Is a lump sum the most appropriate form of giving them that support? Let's look at some claims management approaches, and then we'll look at some recent advances, and then we'll open up for discussion. So the good news is that there have been a lot of improvements in claims management approaches by life insurers. Firstly, there's a recognition of biopsychosocial factors, so factors surrounding the claimant that, if attended to in the right way, can bring out the best claims outcomes. Secondly, in the area of mental health, there's been a recognition of the need for specialist skills and even specialist teams to deal with mental health conditions. Thirdly, because of the particular challenges associated with mental health, it's been recognized that reducing claim portfolio sizes is leading to better results. So, you know, if we really, you know, want to drive effective outcomes, you know, we need to think about the portfolio sizes of our claims assessors. I've talked about how there needs to be consideration about the communication needs of those who are suffering from mental illness. You know, they can't, that there might be barriers that they experience that you and I don't. So how do we communicate with them in a way that connects with them? Super Friends, the non-profit organization associated with a lot of the industry superannuation funds, is about to release a best practice guidelines in the area of treating mental illness cases to lift the standard, which is fantastic news. Connected with the need for specialist skills, some insurers have visiting or in-house psychologist teams and or psychiatrist teams. More and more insurers are seeing the value of employing staff from an allied health background, say nursing, or those with vocational therapy skills, to help claimants get back on their feet, to get back into there. The role of the claims case manager has been really been thought about. So they're no longer someone who merely processes the claims, but because claimant motivation is so critical in claims outcomes, claims managers almost need to have some coaching and skills and the ability to motivate the people that their clients in having the motivation to get better. The focus of quality assurance type teams can't be just on numbers that you're getting through, but when we're assessing the claim, are we coming up with the best treatment plan? Are we making the best decisions in relation to those claims? Of course, to have all this, we need to be, you know, insurers need to be thinking about, are they recruiting the right people? And once you recruit them, are you then training them and supporting them in the right culture to have the best outcomes? And of course, there's been a lot of work. In fact, in 2012, there was a joint signatory between the medical professions about the health benefits of work. And when you think about, you know, you stop and think about why that was necessary, you realize that there might have been some contrary opinions out there about, you know, people, doctors may be keeping people from returning to work when work has great value. So best practice would suggest that it has to be work-focused, evidence-based, sort of a treatment approach. And, of course, rehab is something that if our clients and employers are willing you know, the earlier you can get in there and apply rehab, the best outcomes you'll have. Late notification, sorry, missed one on the other side. Late notifications does continue and tend to continue to be a challenge for mental illness because sometimes there's a reluctance to really put your hand up until it's too late. You try to tough it out. You think it'll go away and that sort of thing. So I think what really I'd like to share with you in closing, and then we'll open up for discussion, just some recent advances that I came across as I was doing my research for this talk. You know, I think most of us are so busy in whatever we do. So it was a challenge for me to find the time, but I was really heartened that when I did do this to see exactly what was happening in this area. So Thomas Insel, he's the director for the National Institute of Mental Health in the U.S., and he's got a quote there that says the economic costs of mental illness will be more than cancer, diabetes, and respiratory ailments put together. But in his TED talk entitled Toward a New Understanding of Mental Illness, he talks about how advances in brain imaging technology, which can now show the differences in the physical structure of a brain of a person suffering from schizophrenia from those who don't. And the point being, the earlier the diagnosis, the better the likelihood of a successful intervention. So there have been advances in diagnostic techniques there. There have been advances in the area of PTSD treatments. And this, of course, affects soldiers. It affects policemen, emergency workers. Anyone see the show American Sniper? Thanks, John. That is a great show for seeing a soldier. It's about an American soldier who was a very successful sniper, but seeing him relive the demons of the battlefield when he came back home and how it affected his family, how isolating it was. That's a great show. But there have been, you see this, there's an image there with someone with those glasses. Some of the latest research have found that virtual reality has been a technique that's been used to help those who are suffering from PTSD to confront those painful memories in a controlled way and to help them process those emotions. Tetris. I'm sure you've played Tetris. I've played Tetris. I came to find out that it was effective as a cognitive vaccine against intrusive memories. And, you know, when you see how addictive it is, you can sort of imagine how powerful it might be. There have been new drugs, or rather drugs that have been used, like even ecstasy, have been found to have some beneficial effects in some of these treatments. There are therapy options, distress tolerance therapies, such as dialectical behavior therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy. There's quite a few areas of therapy. You recall that one of the early slides I showed you the picture from the National Geographic. So a few months ago, there was this whole article about the work that they were doing in the area of shell shock and helping soldiers through that. There have been some advances in the area of genetic discovery and genetic literacy. So there's genome-wide association studies, and this came out of the genome mapping project and the HapMap project that has enabled researchers to identify, instead of having to compare the 3 billion base pairs that are in the DNA sequence, to just analyze a million, which is still a lot, but a lot less than 3 billion, because they found by comparing a group of people with schizophrenia and the patterns that they have in those in the million SNPs or SNPs versus a control group that doesn't have them, they found patterns that indicate that schizophrenia may have a genetic sort of underlying base And again, this helps with earlier detection and treatment. The slide in green is a presentation by the Linda Center of Hope in the U.S., one of the leading centers for mental illness, and its CEO and director, Paul E. Keck, is quoted as saying, "The good news is that remission and recovery is the achievable goal for most psychiatric illness." That's a powerful statement, and I think that he makes that on the basis of the vast improvements in diagnostic accuracy, the enormous advances in efficiency and safety of treatments, with over 25 new medicines and 2 new devices approved since 1988. There have also been 5 new time-limited, focused, illness-specific forms of counselling established. There are new medicines, esinapine, eloperidone. I don't know whether you can get this from the discount warehouse, but it might be available one day. So I've talked about the recent advances in other treatments. There's transcranial magnetic stimulation. That sounds pretty stimulating, which is proven effective for depression and possible benefits for bipolar disorder, PTSD. There's also deep brain stimulation, which has been effective for severe treatment refractory depression, with potential benefit for severe treatment refractory OCD. There's also research currently undergoing with the Mayo Clinic into the genetics of bipolar disorder, and there's a lot of research going on. And the last picture that I'd like to comment on is even in, psychology is going to another level with the work of Dr. Martin Seligman from UPenn, and he came up with it's about positive psychology. So whereas psychology and psychiatry used to take someone from the negative to zero, positive psychology is say, how can we go from surviving to thriving? So it's about positive emotions, it's about engagement, it's about relationships, P-E-R, it's about having motivation and accomplishment. So it's taking it to another level. So where to from here? What does this mean for us as actuaries? I've tried to paint how mental health is a serious issue both locally and globally. There are thousands of life years and lives at stake, and literally billions of dollars. And I believe that we as actuaries have a part to play, both within the life insurance industry, through pricing, product design, but also more broadly, if we choose to engage. And my hope and challenge is that we will engage. I believe that we all have a part to play, both at a personal and a professional level. If you haven't already had someone in your world experience a mental illness, chances are that you, in the course of your lifetime, you will. Therefore, the preparation that you take now to help them in their journey, apart from what you do professionally, I think, it's something that we need to do. Professionally, within the life and health insurance industries and even beyond, within the NDIs, within the government, our skills can be used for social good. So my challenge is, what will you and I do about it? Thank you. For those of you who are interested, so I'd just like to acknowledge Joanne Graves from our National Rehab Manager, who is of great help to me. And for those who are interested in looking at this further, here is just a list of some of the references that, that are part of this presentation. I guess it's time for questions.
Can you hear me now? Yes. Thank you very much, Young. That was a good combination of professional and personal, and I think gave just us all an insight into some of the issues surrounding mental illness. We have 15 to 20 minutes for discussion. Yes. please go to the microphone and please state your name before that, because as we've reminded everybody today and tomorrow, it'll be everything is being recorded.
Andrew Gow from Medibank. Thank you, Young, for this presentation. You've obviously got a lot of passion in this area, and for that I applaud you. For those people wondering, I'm one of the 20% in this room that have suffered from mental illness. I took time off work and ended up being passed from claims team to claims team within National Mutual, or AXA as it was at the time. In the end, my claim was handled out of New Zealand because I was a staff member. It wasn't exactly a very good customer experience for me, so I'm glad that people challenge this. I'd really like to reiterate Young's comment, get outside and actually see. There is no point, if you're interested in this area, go and actually talk to people, go and experience it. It's interesting to see the other side of this. This is probably one of the biggest issues in modern Western society, in a disability sense. It's got a huge cost, both to life insurance but also to the health insurance industry, and it is a challenge that people need to understand, and then they can start discussing and really solve in collaboration with people. Can we be part of that conversation? Yes, we can. The NDIS is one example of that, but we need to do it through things like the Financial Services Council and other bodies like that. It's great also to hear some of the stories around multidisciplinary teams in claims, and I highly commend you for raising that. And I think that's, if other people working at other life offices don't have those sorts of things, then that's one thing they could take away and actually try and implement it, because that would help. But I'd just like to say thank you for your paper.
Yeah, welcome. Yeah, I must say it's very unnerving. With those spotlights, it's very hard because I can't see you, and I, as a presenter, tend to have rely on, you know, what I'm seeing. So that's why I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable here, because I can't really see you guys.
Yeah. Just one comment. Thank you very much, Andrew. It's from your personal experience. It is a question I think worth asking, because we have the right percentages and others for at least one person in this room to have been directly affected by that. The claims management experience that you had, I've seen evidence of that with, you know, a cousin, and also through my sister that I mentioned earlier, and where people fall out of the process very quickly because they can't see the claim getting anywhere, and there's no support function, there's nothing, they just literally fall out of the system. One of my questions to Young is, you know, with your own firm and others, these multidisciplinary teams, the person you gave acknowledgement to at the end from AIA, do you see a trend for better connection with that claimant coming through as something more common?
Look, I hope so. Out of conversation with Joanne, and we have a restore program at AIA, you know, rehab, for it to work, you know, those things that I've put as words, I mean, until there's a lot there. So culture, the support of management, I mean, you know, your boss, your CEO has got to be behind this. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And here's how it plays out. Rehab can sometimes take a number of months, yeah? And so, you know, it's counterintuitive because, you know, when we're asked to, I'm in group insurance, and we're asked to consider, this group of people want, you know, IP to age 65, right? And of course everyone gets, you know, very nervous, understandably, because the liabilities are huge, can be huge. And yet, if you offer a 2-year IP benefit design, right, you may not have the scope within such a short policy. The potential savings from a rehab intervention are so minimal with a two-year IP that you can't justify that from an economic perspective. And so you almost, you know, they won't be allowed to devote the time to helping those claimants. So in that case, wouldn't it be better to actually go, if you feel confident that you have a system in place that you think will work, early intervention and all those things, right teams and all those things, to actually be offering IP to, well, maybe not to age 60, but five-year IP, for instance, that might actually deliver better end outcomes, right, for claimants?
I think we have a question from the floor over here.
Hello. Okay. Robert Kerr from Genry. I think you've sort of started on answering the question I was going to ask, which was, when you were talking, you alluded to that you thought a lump sum benefit wasn't the most appropriate benefit, perhaps. And I was going to ask what you thought was going to be the most appropriate benefit. But I, you know, what do you think that we should be, as health and insurance companies, providing to people with mental illness?
I think a lot more thought needs to go into this. I don't think I've done enough of that, but I think just front of mind, income support, whilst they, so income support to enable them to survive and to tied in with rehab, right? So and with we. You know, you can go down the path of mandatory rehab, but that is a path that we have considered and needs to be thought through carefully, because the law, you know, the law doesn't change human hearts. So you can make something mandatory, and you can get people learning how to beat the system or to qualify in order to get the benefit, but again, what you really want is to engage with the individual who wants to get better, right? You want them participating in the rehab because they do want to get better. It's just like the plenary two plenaries ago when we were talking about Fitbits, right? And that, and how, you know, you could trick the system because you could tie it to your dog, right? But I think that would be such a shame if the person did that, because they found a way of getting a cheaper premium by not doing the work, by not being active. But aren't they missing out on the greater prize of health and fitness by tricking the system? So
that's quite interesting. Robert, you're not long from the UK. Is there systems in the UK that you feel could be, you know, are they similar? Is it similar to here, or something that could be considered here? All right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's. Thank you. Did you want to?
Yeah. If I can. Sorry. It's somehow. This is different from that. Is there a reason for that? Okay. Here. Sorry. Going back to something that I'd like to explain the concrete slab. Sorry. So that was about a crack, obviously, in the foundation, and that related to my friend Laura. And obviously, when in insurance we encounter adults who claim. But like Laura, many of their issues and challenges began when they were a child. So, and in the literature, that in the slide on trends, I mean, there was a lot of literature about trends going up. What was disappointing was that there was no real explanation about what was driving that. But, you know, being aware, and Dr. Daryl Cross, who's a psychologist based in Adelaide, whom I had a chance to listen, who first gave me this idea, if we really want to address mental health as a nation or as an issue, we need to think about the environment our children are growing up in, and are we giving them the best framework, or what do we need to do socially, etc., to create that environment where they can grow up, you know, with self-esteem, with acceptance, you know, that will help them to be resilient adults. So again, I don't have the answers, but I think that's an area, because that's where the cracks may form.
I think there's a lot of societal things potentially, you know, that could be, you know, put in place and utilised. You know, one of the things that issues that always bothers me when I hear about it is the number of people who suicide. Now, the police don't allow, except if there's collateral, which means taking other people with you. You don't often hear about it. Yeah. You know, I was in Singapore on last week, and the ex police sergeant who was driving me to the airport, as we drove past Marina Bay Sands, said, "Oh, did you know an Australian couple committed suicide off there last week?" It wasn't reported in Singapore, but it wasn't reported here either.
Mm-hmm.
And he said there seems to be something about people from Australia and New Zealand. He said, because a New Zealand couple did that last month.
Mm.
So there's a lot of things that, as you say, cracks and things that societal, we're not aware of.
Mm.
And perhaps stigma is part of that. But we have a question over here.
Yeah, I suppose my question links in a little bit to that. Is I've been involved with some people who have had mental health issues before as well, and I generally find that it actually needs to be a community that supports them that actually brings them back. Now, that's it seems to be actually going the opposite way. Like, we're a very individualistic society, and it doesn't seem to be going away from that at all at the moment. So I suppose the question for you is, does that mean that we're likely to see more mental health issues arising from that?
Mm.
And is there ways that society, maybe it's a government thing, can promote societal change to bring communities into the involvement of that side of things?
Mm. And you might be right. And we've moved from a nation that was more religious or more Christian, and as we've modernised, we and I'm not commenting about whether that's right or wrong, but things like that may have had an impact on how we relate to each other, and resulted in greater isolation, as you're saying. And so maybe those things are some of the drivers that I was hoping to find in the literature, but has not been called out as such. But maybe it's, you know, society going this way, becoming postmodern, and so on. You know, greater freedom, but really.
Mm-hmm. So we've had the first bell, so I think we have a time for another question. If anybody else has a question or comment they'd like to make,
just quickly, as you might come out, some encouraging news. So obviously, people also volunteering and trying to do things about this. There's something called the Kids Helpline, and apparently they take thousands of calls from children who might be anxious about this or that. Phenomenal. They raise their own funds. Phenomenal organization.
Yeah.
And there's another group I know, you can Google The Raw Effect, and they're trying to stamp out youth suicide. So I know that's a non-profit group trying to do something about that, recognizing that any one life lost to suicide is just one too many, isn't it?
Yes.
It's just tragic.
You know, a question that's just occurred to me, is there a place for, you know, any insurance or group of insurance companies or a council to have some support mechanism in place for those things that can help support maybe something to think about. We better draw it to a close, but I'd like everybody to thank Young for what was at the start designed as something to stimulate thinking, stimulate discussion, and perhaps take something away from here, and hopefully you feel he's been successful in that. But thank you very much. Thank you.